Today is Tuesday, December the 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thank you for joining us. The Biden administration has announced a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that the administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Winter Games.
We have a fundamental commitment to promoting human rights, and we feel strongly in our position, and we will continue to take actions to advance human rights in China and beyond.
The Russian currency, the ruble, slipped in the red in late trading Monday after U.S. President Joe Biden warned his Russian counterpart Putin of severe economic consequences in case of a Ukraine invasion. This is ahead of a call between the two leaders later today. The World Health Organization reports a significant rise in malaria cases and death in 2020 due to COVID-19 disruptions in malaria services.
An extra 47,000 people have died as a consequence of the disruptions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, the Biden administration has announced that it is planning a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. Speaking to reporters, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that the administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Winter Games because of China's poor human rights record.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses. The athletes on Team USA have our full support. We will be behind them 100% as we cheer them on from home. We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the Games. U.S. diplomatic or official representation would treat these games as business as usual in the face of the PRC's egregious human rights abuses and atrocities in Xinjiang, and we simply can't do that. As the president has told President Xi, standing up for human rights is in the DNA of Americans. We have a fundamental commitment to promoting human rights, and we feel strongly in our position, and we will continue to take actions to advance human rights in China and beyond.
A diplomatic boycott means that no U.S. officials will attend any of the Beijing Olympic events, but Team USA athletes will still be allowed to participate. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin are scheduled to speak via video call as tensions between the two countries escalate over Ukraine.
In terms of the focus of the meeting, as was announced when we announced this weekend, it is an opportunity for the president to underscore, of course, U.S. concerns with Russian military activities on the border with Ukraine and reaffirm the United States support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. It's also an opportunity to discuss a range of topics in the U.S. and Russia relationship, including strategic stability, cyber and regional issues. But you can certainly expect that our concerns about the military activities on the border will be a prominent part of the discussion.
That was White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. In Russia, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that the relations between the two countries were lamentable. He said that Russia was worried about NATO's expansion towards its borders and that President Putin would be seeking long-term security guarantees from the U.S. and its allies, including a pledge that certain types of weapons will not be deployed in countries close to its border. For more on how these two powers find themselves at this low point in their relationship, I reached VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Powell.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to just contextualize it. The two presidents have been dancing around each other at summits and at major events for the last year or so, I would say. And President Putin has, meanwhile, asserted his country's right to surrounding areas, including in Ukraine. And that has rubbed the U.S. the wrong way, and also NATO allies the wrong way, because Ukraine is trying to join the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance, which is, of course, the security compact that holds together countries in Western Europe, and Russia opposes this. So this has been a real sore spot for the two countries, because, of course, President Putin does not want Ukraine to join NATO, and as the Biden administration has said, this is up to only NATO. This is not up to any, this is not necessarily up to us. Mm-hmm. But Russia does see this as a threat, as encroachment on their eastern border. Their recent troop buildup along the Ukrainian border has really evidently alarmed the Biden administration, which is why the two men are going to have this talk.
And what kind of demands or concessions does the U.S. want from Russia, and how much of these are potentially red lines if they're not met?
Well, let's just start with the main issue here that Press Secretary Jen Psaki mentioned earlier today. She says that the president is going to impress upon President Putin that he needs to step back from this aggressive move towards Ukraine, to respect Ukraine's sovereignty, to not send troops across the border, and to not act in such a bellicose manner towards their neighbor. That is front and center in these discussions. There are, of course, going to be other issues discussed, and that includes things like cybersecurity, very, very like multifaceted issues and multilateral issues. And that also includes things like strategic stability, regional issues, in which Russia does have a lot of influence. For example, Russia is one of the parties in the current Iran nuclear negotiations, which are on their seventh round, and so far seem to not be bearing fruit yet again. So the two men are likely to discuss a lot of these wide-ranging issues, but mostly, she said, he's going to narrow in on Ukraine and Russia's moves towards Ukraine.
Mm. And what would possibly Putin be wanting from this phone call?
That's hard to say. In terms of, you have to try to understand why President Putin is doing this in the first place and whether he even intends to actually deploy troops across that border, or if he is doing this to posture and to shore up his own popularity ahead of a very critical election in 2024.
Now, it has been said that Russia has deployed over 70,000 troops along that Ukraine border. How is Putin selling this to his constituency in Russia, this troop buildup and deployments?
I spoke to some very, very well-educated Russia analysts and Ukraine analysts who said it cannot be left out of this discussion that President Putin is running for re-election in 2024. And his concept of himself as a leader and his country on the world stage is very prominent. And this is a way for him to convey that on the world stage and to signal to the United States and to other countries that Russia would like to be taken seriously and like to be given a seat at the table, which they clearly feel that they have not been. So it's not clear whether he actually intends to let loose and fire these troops across the border or not. But the effect is, of course, to remind the people of his country, remind the people of Ukraine, and remind leaders around the world that Russia is not a small force, and it is something to be reckoned with, and is something to be, in their view, respected.
What is the U.S. saying about how they intend to enforce whatever agreement comes out of this?
Right. So White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that their first port of call is always going to be economic action. That would be maybe in the form of sanctions, maybe in letting keeping Russia out of the SWIFT banking system, which, as you may or may not know, is the global banking system that allows you to send money all around the world. It's used by major banks. That would be quite a blow to Russia's economy, which, as we also know, is struggling. They're barely at 1% growth, and this is a big domestic problem for President Putin, who is running for re-election. So that is, I think she said, the first way that the U.S. is looking to put some force behind their words. She did not say what exactly the president would do. She said that's up to him and his advisors, his close advisors in that setting. She would not say whether they were considering military action, but she went back and said, look, there are a range of economic and diplomatic things we can do first. Our first port of call is always diplomacy. As we know, the U.S. and Ukraine do have security agreements, and the U.S. does give Ukraine millions of dollars of security assistance. And so any sort of security assistance, one would imagine, would come in that format and not in, for example, American boots on the ground.
That was VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Paul. The nation's biggest city is imposing one of the United States' most aggressive vaccine rules. AP's Washington correspondent Saga Megani reports.
New York City's mayor says he's ordering a preemptive strike against COVID-19 this winter. Bill de Blasio says all city employers must mandate vaccinations for workers starting later this month. He tells MSNBC's Morning Joe the city must do something bold to stop the virus's growth. Vaccinations are already required for all city employees, plus religious and private school workers. New mandates for indoor dining, entertainment, and gyms will require anyone over 12 to have two vaccine shots. The private sector employee mandate takes effect December 27th, and de Blasio says he expects it will survive any legal challenges. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Voice of America.
At least 38 countries have reported cases of the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus. U.S. President Joe Biden calls the variant a cause for concern, not panic, as scientists work to determine whether it is more dangerous than other strains. Precautionary measures threaten the global recovery from the pandemic, with South Africa crying foul at travel restrictions imposed. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Christmas in quarantine. That might sum up the holiday season for would-be arrivals from southern African nations to London's Heathrow Airport. This after reports of room shortages in so-called quarantine hotels, as the United Kingdom now requires mandatory isolation upon arrival from Southern Africa due to the Omicron variant of the coronavirus.
This turbulence of the booking and the flight changing and then arranging, finding out where you get your PCR tests and driving, you know, 10 miles to go and book it, it takes its toll. You know, you force people to do something, but allow them to do it.
The UK recently mandated a 14-day quarantine for travelers coming from what it considers red list or high-risk countries, like some in southern Africa. The US has restricted travel from several southern African nations as well.
When those were put in, the only cases we knew about were in southern Africa. And really, those restrictions were put in to prevent new variants from coming to the United States and to protect the American people from new variants.
At a recent news conference in Ivory Coast, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa called travel bans unscientific and said they were a slap in the face to the African scientists who first detected the Omicron variant.
Whilst we respect the right of every country to take measures to protect their people, the sustained global cooperation we need to overcome the pandemic necessitates that we are led by science, and not by emotion, and not by political considerations.
As South Africa battles its fourth wave of COVID-19, largely driven by the Omicron variant, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky justified the agency's cautious approach.
We know it has many mutations, more mutations than prior variants, and many of those mutations have been associated with more transmissible variants, with evasion of some of our therapeutics, and potentially evasion of some of our immunity, and that's what we're watching really carefully.
As of Saturday, at least 16 U.S. states reported cases of the Omicron variant. As scientists continue research on Omicron, health officials brace for the spread of what they've called a highly mutated variant. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
International edition continues. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan started a two-day visit to close ally Qatar on Monday. Afghanistan and economic support for Turkey's crisis-ridden economy are expected to be on the agenda of talks between the two countries' leaders. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish and Qatari officials say President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's two-day visit to Qatar aims to further deepen bilateral cooperation. Erdogan will chair Tuesday's meeting of the Turkey-Qatar Supreme Strategic Committee with Qatari Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani in Doha. The two leaders have developed a close relationship built around mutual interests, says former Turkish ambassador to Qatar, Mithat Rende.
Turkish-Qatari relations are important for both countries. The cooperation between the two countries to modernize the armed forces of Qatar and to train the Qatari armed forces by Turkey, that provided a kind of security umbrella for the Qataris. This, in turn, of course, benefited Turkey because Qatar invested heavily in Turkey also.
Security ties were further strengthened by the construction of a Turkish military base in Qatar. Analysts say such support was vital to Doha to resisting Saudi Arabian pressure, which at times has been intense. In 2017, Riyadh imposed a 4-year blockade on Qatar. Erdogan's visit comes as Turkey faces severe economic strains, and the Turkish leader is expected to seek financial support from the energy-rich Emirate. This year, the Turkish currency has lost nearly 50% of its value as international investors fled over Erdogan's unorthodox economic policies. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, speaking in Doha Monday, said Turkey is not seeking a specific amount of money from Qatar, but rather to improve overall economic ties. Hussein Baja, head of the Ankara-based Foreign Policy Institute, says Erdogan will likely be looking to Qatar to add to its $20 billion of investments in Turkey.
Every foreign investment is important for Turkey. Qatar remains for Turkey as the substitute source of international investment.
Qatar has remained a loyal ally to Turkey at a time when Ankara's relations with traditional Western allies have deteriorated. The two countries share similar goals, and they will, on this visit, seek to expand on those. Ankara and Doha back the Egyptian opposition while also cooperating in Libya. Foreign policy analyst Baja says these talks in Qatar will focus on Afghanistan, where the two countries are working to reopen Kabul's international airport.
Qatar has the money and Turkey has technicians. So Turkey has already sent a lot of technicians for the airport in Afghanistan, and Kabul airport will be in operation soon internationally.
A group see the reopening of the Kabul International Airport as vital in alleviating Afghanistan's unfolding humanitarian crisis. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Lebanon's economic crisis deepened last month. This after Saudi Arabia banned the country's imports and expelled its ambassador, citing frustration over the role that Hezbollah, an ally of Saudi rival Iran, plays in Lebanese politics. Lebanese Information Minister George Kodahi, whose remarks about the Saudi-led war in Yemen sparked that row, resigned Friday, hours before the French president and Saudi Arabia's crown prince called Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati. Observers say that the conversation seems to be one step towards a total reconciliation between Lebanon and the Gulf states. George Eid reports for VOA from Beirut.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, French President Emmanuel Macron and Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati held a phone call on Saturday, during which all three countries agreed to work together on reforms in Lebanon. This call came to solve the diplomatic row between several Gulf states and Lebanon after remarks made by former Lebanese Information Minister George Kodahi, in which he criticized Saudi Arabia's role in the war in Yemen and sympathized with the Iran-backed Houthi militia group. The initiative to establish Lebanon's ties with the Gulf countries was announced by the French president one day after Lebanon's information minister resigned to make way for reconciliation. Local Syrian journalist Joyce Akiki, who was present when Kodahi resigned, says the move was essential to get things back on track between Lebanon and the Gulf countries. She says it was clear for the Gulf countries and for President Macron, the resignation of Kodahi was a must in order to pave the way to establish the relations between Lebanon and the Gulf countries. The phone call that took place between Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince and Lebanon's Prime Minister was very important. The call has left a very positive impact in Lebanon. A visit from Lebanon's Prime Minister to Saudi Arabia in the future would be considered another positive step towards total reconciliation. Saudi Arabia had expelled Lebanon's envoy to the kingdom, recalled its ambassador to Beirut, and banned Lebanese imports after comments made by former Lebanese Information Minister George Kodahi. Many Lebanese whose businesses were affected by the decision welcomed the resignation of Kodahi. Rita Farid, who lives in Lebanon, says the resignation was a positive and much-needed move. She says the first step of solving the problem was the resignation of Kodahi, but we all know that the main problem is beyond the remarks he made. We are hopeful that the reconciliation will last and that Lebanon will never have to endure another diplomatic row with the Gulf countries that are an essential pillar of Lebanon's strategic foreign policy.
Reem Harb, a resident of Beirut, considers that the resignation of Kurdahi is not enough.
She says Kurdahi's resignation is not enough to establish stability in Lebanon. The real problem is that the Iran-backed militia group Hezbollah is in control in Lebanon, and this is affecting everything, starting from the country's foreign policy to its current economic crisis. Many of the 400,000 Lebanese expats living in the Gulf were relieved to hear that the ties between Lebanon and the Gulf states have resumed after several weeks of tensions. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
In other news, the U.S. has imposed stricter travel rules to the U.S. beginning this week amid a surge in COVID-19 death and new cases of the Omicron variant. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the country is averaging more than 100,000 new cases each day. Starting this week, international travelers will be required to show a negative test within one day of departure, as against 3 days previously. Omicron-linked infections have been detected in at least 16 states. U.S. health officials say that while the variant is rapidly spreading in the country, early indications suggest it may be less dangerous than Delta, which continues to drive a surge of hospitalizations. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, Upfront Show, Africa 54 TV Show, Straight Talk Africa, and others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In a new advance for robot technology, a group of New England scientists have created a living robot that can make copies of itself. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in today's Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from Tufts and Harvard University and the University of Vermont may have made one of the most amazing discoveries in robot technology. In a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the team reports creating living robots from frog embryo cells that can self-replicate. According to a University of Vermont press release, these millimeter-wide so-called xenobots are designed by computer and made by hand. The bots swim out of their tiny dish home, find and gather hundreds of single cells, assemble them in their mouths, and after a few days, baby bots that look and perform like their parent are created. The researchers suggest that xenobots could someday be implanted and trained for tasks such as picking up medicine and delivering it to a part of the body that needs it. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
International Edition continues. The World Health Organization reports a significant rise in malaria cases and death in 2020 due to COVID-19 disruptions in malaria services. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the WHO's latest World Malaria Report.
Over the past two decades, global malaria death rates have been cut in half, saving the lives of 10.6 million people. New data gathered by the WHO show COVID-19 has stopped and even reversed the progress made in reducing deaths from this preventable, treatable disease. The WHO's World Malaria Report estimates 241 million malaria cases and 627,000 malaria deaths globally have occurred in 2020. This represents an increase of 14 million cases and 69,000 deaths compared to the previous year. WHO links the increase to disruptions of malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment services during the pandemic. Director of WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says the situation could have been far worse. The good news, he says, is that the predicted doomsday scenario did not transpire. He notes gloomy projections made in March 2020 of a huge spike in malaria have not materialized.
One worst-case scenario implied a doubling of malaria deaths. So let me reiterate this. That is not the case. We can call this a success story, even though an extra 47,000 people have died as a consequence of the disruptions.
The report finds progress in the global fight against malaria remains uneven. Between 2000 and 2020, WHO has certified 12 countries as being malaria-free. Two countries, China and El Salvador, have achieved this status in 2021, despite the ongoing pandemic. Since 2015, both cases and deaths have stalled in most of the world's 93 endemic countries and territories. However, other figures show malaria cases have increased in 32 countries, most in sub-Saharan Africa and some in South America. Alonso says the situation remains especially precarious in Africa, where the malaria burden remains unacceptably high. He notes Africa accounts for about 96% of global deaths, 80% among children under age 5.
And at the same time, the pandemic is not over, and the pace of economic recovery is uncertain. Without immediate and accelerated action, key 2030 targets of the WHO Global Technical Strategy will be missed, and additional ground may be lost.
WHO strategy calls for a 90% reduction in malaria cases and deaths by 2030. It also presses for the elimination of malaria in at least 35 countries and for the prevention of disease resurgence in all countries that are malaria-free. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In the shadows of the coronavirus pandemic, violence against women has been on the rise around the world, including in South Africa, where half of the country's women report at least one incident of violence in their lifetime. Now, a local tech company has developed an alarm system to help stop the abuse. For VOA, Linda Geftash reports from Johannesburg.
A click of a button could save a woman's life. That's what South African firm Afritech Technologies hopes to achieve with its Alert app. Gender-based violence has become so rampant during coronavirus lockdowns, President Cyril Ramaphosa has called it the country's second pandemic. Afritech presents its app as one solution, allowing users to discreetly alert friends, family, and authorities that they're in danger. AB Musa is the CEO of Afritech Technologies.
We're not saying that our tech or our solution is the silver bullet, but it certainly is one of the pieces of this big puzzle that can make a difference. And I think COVID became a catalyst for a lot of people to adopt, a lot more people to adopt technology. And hence why we felt creating a technological solution.
The South African Police Service says more than 10,000 people were raped between April and June this year. Another 15,000 cases of domestic violence were reported in the same period. Organizations providing support to survivors say those figures don't paint a full picture, as many more cases go unreported. The lack of data about the crisis is another solution Afritech plans to provide with the information it collects from users.
We're also putting AI systems behind our app to be able to then hopefully predict trends of what's going to happen. So empower police stations, empower private security, empower NGOs to then be able to have a proactive rather than a reactive response to this challenge.
People without smartphones can still use the alert system. The company has designed a panic button that looks like a USB stick, as well as a wristwatch that provides the same response. Social workers say these interventions will make a big difference, but more still is needed. Leisha Stevens is a social worker with the NISA Institute for Women's Development in Johannesburg.
We need to target families. Ask, why is this happening? Is it a tradition? Is it your family history? Is it your background? And if so, how can we change it? And ultimately, we need to pay attention to our children. What are we teaching them?
Advocates like Stephen say the public as a whole need to be educated on what gender-based violence is and how to respond to it.
How do we break the cycle with my attitude, my view of what gender-based violence is? I am a neighbor. I see this happening. I close my door and I go inside. So where's the disconnect that we need to understand?
Witnesses of violence can report incidents to police or via a national hotline or nonprofits, and they can do so anonymously. If more people intervened, Stevens believes it could be life-changing for victims and help shift the culture so that gender-based violence is no longer the norm. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.